Chapter 8. The Conspiracy in the Temple. For 2 days longer, the party lingered by the side of the lake, fishing and fowling, and then returned across the desert to the headquarters of Ameres. 2 months were spent in examining canals and watercourses, seeing that the dikes were strengthened where needed, and that the gates and channels were in good repair. At last, Ameres left one of his subordinates to carry out the work, and started with his son for Thebes. A fortnight after his return home, he was informed that a young female, who said her name was Ruth, wished to see him. He bade the servant conduct her to him, and at the same time summon Kebron from his studies. The lad arrived first, and as Ruth entered, presented her to his father.
"Welcome, child, to this house," the high priest said. "I suppose by your coming that your grandfather is no more?"
"He died a month since, my lord," Ruth replied.
"Kebron, tell Mysa to come here," Ameres said, and the lad at once fetched Mysa. "This is Ruth, Mysa," Ameres said when she entered, "who has come to be with you, and I need not tell you to be kind and considerate with her. You will soon make her at home, I hope."
"I will try and make her happy," Mysa replied, looking at her new companion. "I will do my best to please you, for your father and brother have been very good to me,"
Ruth replied, looking admiringly at Mysa's bright face. Although the girls were about the same age, Ruth looked the elder of the two. Ruth had long had many responsibilities on her shoulders, and there was an expression of thoughtfulness and gravity in her eyes. Mysa, on the contrary, was still but a happy child who had never known the necessity for work or exertion. Her life had been like a summer day, free from all care and anxiety. Before many days were over, Ruth became quite at home in her new abode. Her position was a pleasant one. She was at once companion and attendant to Mysa, accompanying her in her walks, playing with her in the garden, helping her to feed the animals, and amusing her when she preferred to sit quietly, by telling her about her life near the lake by the great sea, about the fowling and fishing there, and especially about the river close to the cottage, with its hippopotami and crocodiles. Ruth brightened up greatly in her new surroundings, which to her were marvelous and beautiful, and she soon caught something of the cheerfulness of her mistress, and the laughter of the two girls was often heard rising from Mysa's enclosure at the further end of the quiet garden. Shortly after the return from their visit to Lower Egypt, Kebron was initiated into the lowest grade of the priesthood. His duties, at first, were slight, and therefore interfered but little with his studies or ordinary mode of life, and he was almost as much at home as before. He could now, however, enter the temples at all hours, and had access to the inner courts and chambers and other places where none but the priests were permitted to enter. He availed himself of this privilege chiefly of an evening. All the great courts were open to the sky, and Kebron loved to roam through them in the bright moonlight, when they were deserted by the crowd of worshippers, and all was still and silent. Upon the altars before the chief gods fire ever burned, and in the light of the flickering flames the faces assumed life and expression. He found that his mind was then attuned to a pitch of reverence and devotion to the gods that it failed to attain when the sun was blazing down upon the marble floor and the courts were alive with worshippers. Then, strive as he would, he could not enter as he wanted into the spirit of the scene. He was shocked at his own doubts, and did his best to banish them from his mind. Sometimes he thought of speaking to his father and confessing to him that his mind was troubled with doubts. But the thought of the horror with which such a confession would be received deterred him from doing so. Even to Amuba he was silent on the subject, for Amuba, he thought, would not understand him. Nevertheless, he sometimes took Amuba with him in his visits to the temple. Near the house of Ameres stood that of Tylus, a priest who occupied a position in the temple of Osiris next in dignity to that of the high priest. Between the two priests there was little cordiality, for they differed alike in disposition and manner of thought. Tylus was narrow and bigoted in his religion, precise in every observance of ceremonial. Austere and haughty in manner, he professed to despise all learning beyond that relating to religion, and was secretly devoured with jealousy at the esteem in which Ameres was held by the court, and his reputation as one of the first engineers, astronomers, and statesmen of Egypt. Tylus had been one of the fiercest in the opposition raised to the innovations proposed by Ameres, and had at the time exerted himself to the utmost to excite such a feeling against him as would render it necessary for him to resign his position in the temple. His disappointment had been intense when, owing in no slight degree to the influence of the king himself, his intrigue came to nothing. But he had ever since kept an unceasing watch upon the conduct of his colleague, without, however, being able to find the slightest pretense for complaint against him. For Ameres, having failed in obtaining a favorable decision as to the views he entertained, had not striven against the tide, and was as exact as ever in his ministration in the temple. A certain amount of intimacy was kept up between the two families. Although there was no more liking between the wives of the two priests than between their husbands, they were of similar dispositions. Both were fond of show and gaiety, and both were ambitious. In their entertainments and feasts there was a constant rivalry between them, although the wife of the high priest considered it nothing short of insolence that the wife of one inferior to her husband's rank should venture to compete with her, while upon the other hand, the little airs of calm superiority her rival assumed when visiting her excited the deepest indignation and bitterness in the heart of the wife of Tylus. Ameres had never alluded at home either to his views concerning religion or to his difference of opinion with his colleagues. There was but little in common between him and his wife. He allowed her liberty to do as she chose and to spend money as she liked, so long as his own mode of life was not interfered with. He kept in his own hands, too, the regulation of the studies of Kebron and Mysa. One day, when he was in his study, his wife entered. He looked up with an expression of remonstrance, for it was an understood thing that when occupied with his books he was on no account to be disturbed except upon business of importance.
"You must not mind my disturbing you for once, Ameres, but an important thing has happened. Nicotis, the wife of Tylus, has been here this afternoon, and what do you think she was the bearer of? A proposal from her husband and herself that their son Plexo should marry Mysa."
"She is a child at present. The thing is ridiculous."
"She is nearer 15 than 14, and betrothal often takes place a year earlier."
Ameres was silent. What his wife said was perfectly true, and Mysa had reached the age at which the Egyptian maidens were generally betrothed. It came upon him, however, as an unpleasant surprise. He regarded Mysa as still a child, and his affections were centered in her and Kebron. For his eldest son, who resembled his mother in spirit, he had but little affection or sympathy.
"Very well," he said at last. "If Mysa has reached the age when we must begin to think whom she is to marry, we will think of it. But there is no occasion for haste. As to Plexo, he is arrogant and overbearing, and at the same time shallow and foolish. Such is not the kind of youth to whom I shall give Mysa."
The answer did not quite satisfy his wife. She agreed with him in objecting to the proposed alliance, but on entirely different grounds. She had looked forward to Mysa making a brilliant match, which would add to her own consequence and standing. Such result would certainly not flow from Mysa's marriage to the son of one of less rank in the temple than her husband, and far inferior in public estimation. Being content, however, that her husband objected to the match on other grounds, she abstained from pressing her own view of the subject, being perfectly aware that it was one with which Ameres would by no means sympathize. "You will say to Nicotis that from what I have seen of Plexo, and from what I have learned of his character, it does not appear to me that a union between him and Mysa would be likely to conduce to her happiness, and that therefore I decline altogether to enter into negotiations for the bringing about of such a marriage." Amensi was well pleased, for she felt that this message, given in her husband's name, would be a great rebuff for her rival. Had Amensi been present when Nicotis informed Tylus of the refusal of the proposal for the hand of Mysa, she might have felt that even the satisfaction of mortifying a rival may be dearly purchased.
You know the woman, Tylus, and can picture to yourself the air of insolence with which she declined our proposal. And it was, you say, against Plexo personally that the objection was made,
Tylus said.
So she seemed to say. Of course she would not tell me that she had set her mind on her daughter marrying one of the royal princes, though it is like enough that such is her thought, for the woman is pushing and ambitious enough for anything. Let them both beware,
Tylus said.
They shall learn that we are not to be insulted with impunity. This Ameres, whom the people regard as so holy, is at heart a despiser of the gods. Had he not been a favorite of Thutmose, he would ere now have been disgraced, and I should be high priest in his place. Then,
Nicotis said decidedly,
Ameres must not hold office for many more years. You have always promised me that some day I should be the wife of the high priest, and that Plexo should stand first in the succession of the office. It is high time you carried your promises into effect. It is time, Nicotis. This last insult decides me. Had he agreed to our proposal, I would have laid aside my own claims, and with my influence could have secured that Plexo, as his son-in-law, should succeed, rather than that shallow-brained fool, Necho. He has refused the offer, and he must bear the consequences.